Steve, thanks for joining us. Now, we've got 25 minutes where I'm going to get you to explain the economic problems of the world and how we can solve them. The IT challenges of the world and how we can cash in on it and make a lot of money out of the whole thing. And also, we want to get to know you. So let's start off with you, Steve Ballmer. This is your life. Born March 24, 1956. I was born March 27, 1954. But the similarities don't end there.
No, they don't.
Hey, he stole them a punchline. You are tall, I am tall, and I also have a kind of hairline that I admire. You have that as well. So we're bound to get on, or else we'll be so competitive we'll kill each other.
There you go.
All right. Now, many great business performers, people who I've interviewed here like Jack Welch, who I'm sure you know, are often become well known for quotes that they've made, and they're often short ones. And Jack's most famous one to me is, "If you haven't got a competitive advantage, don't compete." And Buffett, of course, is, "When everyone's brave, I'm fearful. When everyone's fearful, I'm brave." Homer Simpson is dull, of course. But I've looked into your quotes, Steve, and they're really long ones. So you might not become famous. That's the first thing. But I love this quote, and I'd love you to explain it, particularly in terms of cloud computing, which I know is something that you really care about. "The number one benefit of information technology is that it empowers people to do what they want to do. It lets people be creative. It lets people be productive. It lets people learn things they didn't think they could learn before. And so, in a sense, it's all about potential." Can you explain that in terms of what cloud computing is going to actually offer everyone in this room?
Yeah, when we talk about cloud computing, what we're really talking about is the next wave of sort of the plumbing, almost, of how computing works. The plumbing's interesting to the plumbers, but I'll spend a lot of time talking about it, because plumbers, in some senses, need to build the future. But the way we'll build the future essentially will allow people to get more access to more applications more quickly and at lower cost than ever before. And behind that is the notion that software and systems are going to run out in the internet. That's what we call the cloud, in addition to running in corporate data centers and on PCs and phones. And you could say, hey, isn't that just the internet? Well, the truth of the matter is, the internet's been so far mostly a delivery vehicle for information, or a social interaction vehicle. It hasn't been a place where sort of mainstream computing has moved. And that's what's happening now. The plumbing's changing, but more applications, more quickly, to more people at lower costs. That's what it's about.
Could you help us by maybe giving us an example of a business and how it operates now, and compare how it will when cloud computing becomes something that everyone embraces?
How many of your businesses have a data center? Nobody will put their hand up in 10 years. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. Fine, maybe it's 15 years, and maybe two people still put their hands up. But
Half the people didn't know what a data center is.
Yeah, I knew that. I figured that out after I asked. But, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is take the cost and the complexity out of information technology. Here's a statistic. If you look in the U.S., probably same would be true in Australia, most developed countries, IT is the number one or number two kind of job classification in the country. In the U.S., it's auto worker and somebody who somehow is building, deploying, managing software. And yet there's so many things that still aren't getting done, not just in businesses, but also in people's personal lives. And so the question is, how does our industry continue to deliver great new innovation? Answer, we got to make things simpler. And the best way to make things simpler is to let people stop doing some of the stuff they're doing today, move it on out to the internet, push that to guys like Microsoft, and then let people really focus in on what makes sense to them.
So in a sense, you're creating an IT solution to an area of weakness so people can work in their strength zone, in a sense.
That's right. And to basically take things, today, we give you a disk, whatever you are, IT manager, we give you a disk and say, have at it. tomorrow we say, here, just type in a name and password. We're going to do more for you. We'll copy what you need down on the PC. We'll just run it all for you instead of having you do that all for yourself. And that takes out the complexity, the cost, and kind of allows you to simply get access to more applications to help you realize your potential.
Okay, I'm sure you might have heard that Rupert Murdoch delivered a speech.
I did.
And he made the pretty subtle observation that Microsoft's dominance was going to be, is over. So what's your reaction to that, Steve? I know you're a bit of a shrinking violet when you hear criticism of that kind, or observations of that.
Well, I don't know if it's criticism or not. I mean, given the level of interaction I have with Rupert, if it was criticism, I'll have back at him the next time we get together.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we're a successful company. If we drive hard, if we innovate, we're going to be a super successful company a long, long time into the future. At the end of the day in our business, as long as you keep pushing forward, you have great opportunity. And at the end of the day, most of what's going to happen in the next 10 years hasn't been invented yet anyway. And what we're trying to do is kind of three things. Number one, we're trying to reinvent the areas where we're strong, and there's a lot of those. We're trying to create innovations that dislocate the leaders in some markets where we're not strong, .. And just in case. And number three, we're trying to invent brand new things that nobody has really conceived of yet. And are we going to have competitors that are trying to do some combination of those things? And they're sure, of course we are. And yet, I think in our industry, the companies that get successful and then fade, they fade because they're not pushing forward hard enough. They get too narrow. They try too much just to preserve the status quo. Why are we embracing cloud computing? Well,
we do that in this country.
I thought it was back in Japan there for a minute. But if somebody's gonna change the model of the way we do things, it's gonna be us. Let's get on it. Let's get after it. And so I think the opportunity for us to continue to lead is incredibly strong. Now, if what Rupert is really saying is, hey, let's let somebody else, say Google, have all the antitrust problems, I say, hey, I'm with you, Rupert, let's go.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned the G word. So you guys in particular were worried about the anti-competitive nature of Google and Yahoo getting together. And the outcome has actually gone the way I presume you wanted. You wouldn't have liked to see Google and Yahoo get together. What's your next play? Are you going to show interest in Yahoo at half the price again?
No.
No.
No. Look, we made an offer. We made another offer. It was clear that Yahoo didn't want to sell the business to us, and we moved on. We tried at one point to do a partnership around search, not an acquisition. And that didn't work either, and we moved on, and they moved on. We are not interested in going back and relooking at an acquisition. I don't know why they would be either, frankly. They turned us down at $33 a share. Move on. Let's go ahead. We're in the game. I'm sure there's still opportunities for some kinds of partnership around search, but I think acquisition is a thing of the past.
One thing Rupert talked about was Google's current domination, particularly as a gatekeeper. We all seem to go through Google first. How are you going to respond to that? That's something, obviously, that you're not going to ignore, and you're going to come up with something better, I presume.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, in order to compete in search, there's probably about three or four different things we have to do. Number one, we've got to do the kinds of things, the basics that the other guy does, at least as well, if not better. And that means when you go to look for something, we got to give you as relevant information as anybody on the planet. Now, that's not going to change the game, but that's kind of what I might call the opening stakes. Number two, we got to reinvent the whole darn thing. If anybody thinks that the future of search is going to look like the present of search, that's crazy. The user interface on search hasn't changed for 6 years. You still get the same dull, boring 10 blue links, for God's sake. Can't we do any better than that? And it's even worse. The average search in English is 2.2 words. Because everybody on the planet has figured out that search engines are so dumb that if you tell them more, they actually do a worse job. You know, if I had an administrative assistant that was as bad as a search engine, I'd really be in trouble. I'd like to tell her more, and she gives me more. There's opportunity for innovation. You know, nothing has changed in so long. And so the question is, how do we reinvent the business model? How do you reinvent the business model? Because at the end of the day, it's somehow about commerce that funds the whole thing. So the business model, the user experience, the relevance, even what you're trying to do. When you go search, are you really usually looking for a set of websites? No, you're usually looking to get something done. You're trying to buy some flowers. You're not trying to find 10 links to a place to go buy flowers. You know, there's no task orientation in the way we look at search today. So the opportunity to innovate is high. And one of two things will happen. Either we will be successful, or the market will stagnate. Because as we know, I certainly know, everybody needs a good competitor. And we just want the other guys in this business to have a good competitor that they have to think about every day.
Okay, so imagine you've got, you have two children?
Three.
Three. And one of them comes to you later in life and says, Dad, Steve, I want to open a business. What advice would you give them in terms of creating a business that becomes the next Microsoft? Or even something. Not quite.
I tell them if their goal is to create a business that becomes the next Microsoft, they ought to keep thinking. Because you can't, it's a mistake you can make is to set out to build a business that's got some arbitrary kind of scale or financial measure associated with it. If that had been what we had done at Microsoft, I don't think we'd be as successful as we are today, because it gets you to spend too much, to do too much, to anticipate too much. I still remember the day Andy Grove, who was running Intel, said, someday there'll be 100 million microprocessors sold a year, 100 million PCs, and Bill and I both laughed and said, ha, 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 Andy's really lost his mind this time. And then this year there'll be 300 million. Yeah. See, you don't want to, what I would tell my kids to do is take something that you really understand, where you have some unique insight, where you think you can, you know, contribute some unique value and make something happen. And bring all the passion and enthusiasm and energy you can to it. But bring a unique insight. And if you have no unique insight, keep busy with something else until you have one at the end of the day. That's just like something Buffett likes to say. Buffett says, look, I don't have to be right most of the time. I'm going to make two or three or four big bets over the course of the entire career, and so I don't have to bet well every day. I just got to make a few big bets successfully. And I tell anybody trying to start a business, it's not about just trying to do something willy-nilly. Get your unique insight and then go after it.
On the subject of unique insight, Fortune magazine in December of last year had a fantastic headline, and it featured four of the CEOs from the leading financial institutions on Wall Street, and the heading, which I really wish I'd used, was, what were they smoking? And when I saw you do your dance monkey boy dance, I thought to myself, as a CEO, what were you thinking, or what were you smoking when you decided to do that? Because it was a great innovation. I loved it. It's compelling. I showed my 28-year-old son, who's our general manager in our operation, and when he saw it, he just was over the moon. But what were you thinking, and why did you do that?
Yeah, just for perspective, in case somebody hasn't seen this wacky thing, you know, I get excited before I go in front of our employees to talk. I don't know what it's like for the rest of you, but actually the people who care most about what you have to say are your employees. You know, I'm grateful that you're all here today and you're interested and you might be a little amused or not amused, but if the employees of Microsoft are in the audience, they care, because their future is tied up with our future. So before I get on stage to talk to big groups of our employees, and we do it twice a year, I get 15,000 in one pop, and I get about 27,000 people in another pop. You know, I'm thinking, what do I want to say? What's the tone? How do I want to communicate? But then when I get on stage, I'm kind of I'm an emotional, kind of enthusiastic guy. So somebody posted on YouTube me being a little enthusiastic, you know, talking about my love of the company. Or it could be another one of the wacky ones in front of customers. My love of software developers. You know, those plumbers.
Yeah.
I love those plumbers. And I wasn't thinking anything particularly. I was living in the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it does create, in a sense, your own unique dance. And we have a quite a famous politician who once was the lead singer of Midnight Oil, who created Daggy. Was it Daggy Dancing? Did we call it that in those days when Peter Garrett sang a song? But we appreciate people who dance stupidly, and we make them ministers of the crown. So you're really in very good company here.
I now know what my dancing looks like. Thank you very much.
Now, you joined Microsoft when they had around 24 employees, and you took a small salary of $50,000. And then I have to ask this question, like, what were you thinking when you decided to take 7% of this company? Was this a courageous decision at the time?
Actually, it's sort of a funny story. I was trying to decide what to do for summer job in business school. Bill calls, and he tries to get me to drop out. And it actually was $40,000. And
this is just plus,
plus someplace between 5 and 10% based upon... It was the deal he actually offered me was $40,000 a year plus 10% of all of the increase in profits in the company. It wasn't even a corporation, it was a partnership, and I could get 10% of the increase. And we never had a bit of discussion about the 10%. I wrangled with him, though, for 2 days. I said, look, you know, most business school graduates can make $50,000. And I think this could be a really bad deal for me. But we worked it through. It was okay.
So you met Bill at Harvard,
right?
Did you instantly become mates, or was it something that developed over time and you had a certain strength?
No, pretty quickly. We lived sort of down the hall each other our sophomore year in university, and one of our mutual friends said, you two guys are both kind of weird guys, but you like each other. Even though you're opposite weird, Steve is... social and weird, Bill is antisocial and weird, but you two would really like each other. And he was right, we did.
Now, did you do accountancy? I know you're a maths major, but did you do accountancy as well? Because you are, you know, regarded as a person who's important for the financial foundations of Microsoft. But you know,
no, I took one accounting course my first year of business school. That's all I know, actually, at all about accounting.
I recall...
I'm sorry. And what I've had to learn to sign my Sarbanes-Oxley at that time.
When I told...
And I have decent numbers, and I'm sure I'm in trouble right now with somebody.
When I taught at the University of New South Wales, my colleague was then a guy called Dr. John Houston, who went on to become opposition leader in the country. And he once said that an economist, which he is and which I am, is nothing more than an accountant with a personality. Which is a hard call given his personality. But you seem to interwove the important role of leadership in a company like yours with a big personality. Was it something that you've worked on? Were you a natural leader, I guess, is at the bottom? Or have you said, this is my personality and I will create my own kind of leadership?
Well, I'm not sure I ever really thought about it quite that way. Most of what I sort of think of as my, development experiences in leadership were actually in university. When I was in university, I was the football team manager, which meant the organizer. And getting up in front of people and speaking was part of the drill. And I ran advertising sales for the school newspaper. And those were kind of formative, really more formative for me than anything else. And everything else, I just kind of develop my own style, if you will, on the job at Microsoft, and it's worked for me.
In terms of where you see your industry going and how we should be preparing for it, what are the main developments out there that are going to become substantial and will affect the way we do business and the way we even think about business?
Yeah. I mean, I try to get you to prepare for it. But let me give you the fundamental big idea. At the end of the day, we talk about our mission as a company, enable people and businesses throughout the world to realize their full potential. Mm-hmm. That was kind of where you're building. And at the end of the day, the most important advances are the advances that give people more access to the machines, to the information, and to other people. How do we improve access? Make it simpler to find things. Make it simpler to communicate with people. Make it simpler to control and master the machines. Enabling access. Because if we can give access, there's somebody who can write an application for education or health or scientific modeling or whatever the case may be. So the core innovations that we focus in are sort of these access improvements. And if you go out 10 years, things are going to be fantastically different. You know, 10 years from now, this is a digital screen. And I'll say, hey, look, let me just show you. And I'll click and I'll bring up and I'll point out some things. And everybody will say, will we be able to see them? And of course, because you'll have a digital screen that is as thin and light and attached to the internet as a piece of paper. And can we improve access to the tech? Sure. And instead of saying file open, I'll just say to the computer, hey, bring up the demo that shows natural language. And it'll recognize what I meant. I won't have to learn the language of the computer. When we talk about it, you know, enabling better access to people, where's the video? There's a video guy. There's a video guy at a lot of speeches I give. There are very few people I've ever met who've watched a speech. They've watched the little YouTube clip, but they don't watch the speech. Why? It's too dull to sit there and watch speeches. But if, you know, Tracy Fellows, who runs our business in Australia, she's marking notes. Boy, Steve was out of line here. Boom! Then people would just get the note, click, and it would index automatically into the video. Because I know the people who work for us in Seattle are kind of dying to know what I'm saying on stage here today. Boom! But that would, instead of people sitting there real time going through these things, we'll really think about video conferencing not as a crazy add-on, but virtual meetings and video is fundamental. Improved access to people. And I already talked about search. Finding what you want and getting something done, whether it's in your personal life or your professional life. You talk to most CEOs and you ask them what's their number one frustration with IT. You know, the CIOs usually think, oh, they think we're too expensive. We think this, we think that. What most CEOs tell me is, I can never seem to get an answer to the one question I really have. You know, I can't find it. And yet the computers have the information. People just want to say, hey, what is our claims experience for automobile insurance in Queensland? I have to be able to just say that, and it just fans out, gets the information, brings it back, and lets me play with it in some way and visualize it. That was a technical term. So, you know, access to people, access to information, and access to the devices. Things are going to change a lot in the next several years.
Okay, this, before we go to the audience, a couple of quick questions. The U.S. economy, how long do you think it'll be in recession? Do you have those kinds of indicators coming through to you that make you think it's going to be a six-month, a one-year recession? And we want you to be right. Don't guess.
I have no idea.
Okay, right. Okay.
I know we have issues, and it's not just the U.S. economy. We've seen the same thing in Europe. My number one leading edge indicator is how many PCs are getting sold. And we saw drop-off in PC sales not only in the U.S., we've seen drop-off also in Western Europe. How long will this continue? I think there depends on a lot of things, not the least of which is, you know, we got to get out of a sense of pessimism and back into a sense of optimism. There are real problems. There's real problems in our housing sector, in the financial markets, et cetera. But as long as we're still in the downward spiral where people don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, you're going to get job cuts, unemployment, and, you know, hopefully with the elections behind us, maybe that's the time for psychology to start changing, although you couldn't tell that by the financial markets the last couple of years.
No. Obama, do you think he'd be good for a positive attitude?
I think, you know, the country's ready for a new leader. People clearly spoke during our election, and I think now's the time for sort of people to rally behind. The president's got a tough job, and President Obama will have a tough job not only on all of the foreign affairs matters of the past, but on these economic matters.
One last one, China. China is very important for your business going forward. What's your sense? Is it slowing down faster than what people think? Or I know it's a hard question, but once again, we need you to be right on this.
Well, then let me make sure I make sure you're right first. China's not really very important to our business right now. I'd like it to be, but because of the high rate of piracy of intellectual property in China, you know, China's the second largest consumption, not production, but consumption market for PCs. There will be 48 million PCs bought in China this year, and that compares to, say, 4.5 million in Australia. So it's but we need some intellectual property reform in China for it to be important to our financial results. That's all upside for us, for those of you who care about our stock. But in terms of the Chinese economy, we have not seen big negative indicators in terms of PC sales. And yet things have, you know, an 8% growth rate versus a 12% growth rate really is a big deal and probably has a big impact on kind of what exports will look like into the Chinese market. But, you know, I'm not the guy to make that forecast.